Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 67 featuring Ben Grossman. Sean is joining me for the podcast today. We are going to do something a little new on the podcast. Sean, why don't you tell people about it?
Okay, we're going to start this new thing. It's called hashtag Ask Vlado.
Right. Hashtag Ask Vlado. Explain people how this is going to work.
So you're going to hit us up on our social.
Yeah.
On our soch. Hit us up on the soch. On our Twitter.
Yeah.
At Chaos Group. On our Facebook. On our Instagram. I don't know.
Whatever you want.
Yeah. Wherever you want.
And you can do it at the Chaos Group. If you want to do it at Chaos Group, at CG Labs, you can do it there as well.
Yeah.
But go ahead and if you're connected with us on our social networks, go ahead and do that. And ask a question.
Yeah, ask a question for Vlado. Hashtag it, Ask Vlado.
Let's keep these questions like a little bit more fun, a little bit more enjoyable. If you have actually serious issues about or things you want to ask, save those for the forum or for support or any other ways that you communicate. This is more just for fun on the podcast. And if you have some interesting questions, some ideas you want to know, something you want to know about his thoughts on the future, go ahead and ask Vlado. And we are going to read them on the intro next time when we'll credit you guys and say, here you go. This is what Vlado has to say. So why don't we go ahead and do that? So Sean's going to help us out. Yep. Thank you, Sean. All right. So Ben Grossman. Ben Grossman is a very interesting person. Ben is was actually a visual effects supervisor. He's actually taking a little bit of a hiatus from visual effects right now. He has started a new company called Magnopus. Some people call it Magnopus. Either way, it's a fun company. Ben actually did win an Oscar for his work on Hugo. I actually spent quite a bit of time with him. I ended up recording the podcast over there at their office in downtown LA. I ended up staying there for 6 hours, checking out all the amazing work that's being done over there. So much creative work. It's really, really, really incredible. And very peripherally related to visual effects, a lot of VR work, a lot of game work, a lot of art installations. So a really great, great podcast. I loved having Ben on the podcast, being able to hang out with him. I have a feeling that Ben and I are going to spend a lot more time together coming up some cool labs projects. All right, guys. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
All right, I'm looking forward to lunch. So I was just thinking that I think the last time I physically saw you was when you were interviewing me at Cafe FX.
Oh, wow.
So that's got it. How long was that be?
You're going to discover over the course of the next block of time that I am terrible at dates.
Okay, my guess,
if it was Cafe FX, it was before they closed down, which means it was right about the time of Alice in Wonderland, which puts it around 2009-2010.
Yes, because I hadn't gone to DD yet, and I was looking at you guys as well.
Oh,
at that point.
Well, then.
So that was probably
then
around
it could have been anywhere between 2005 and 2000.
Well, yeah, I think it was probably around 2009. 2009, I guess.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. You guys were working on a concert thing for, or had just finished a concert thing for the Rolling Stones with Scorsese.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Shine a Light.
Shine a Light.
Shine a Light. Yeah. That was awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, so yeah, that was at the Syndicate, right?
That's
so
the Syndicate.
Cafe
That's
FX
right.
owned the Syndicate. Syndicate was sort of the commercials.
And that was in Santa Monica.
In Santa Monica, right. Yeah. But we ended up doing more. It's kind of like DD, too. Similar path.
Right.
The commercials department started doing features. Because they brought a different approach to that process that worked well for a new style of filmmaking. So.
And you, similar to Barbara, you had a relationship with Martin Scorsese the way that he had with Fincher and sort of
Yeah. I mean, and I would describe mine more as through Rob Legato.
Through Rob Legato.
So,
right.
So while certainly I've worked with Marty directly on projects when Rob was doing other things, on that particular project and with a director like Martin Scorsese,
right.
It's all hands on deck.
Sure.
So Fincher, you know, with former visual effects experience,
uh-huh.
likes to get his hands dirty right into the nitty gritty of things. Marty yep. is a different type of filmmaker.
Yeah, he trusts Rob to do all that yeah. stuff for him.
Yeah, so it usually, it takes a village.
Yeah.
But it definitely takes a personality like Rob to be able to spearhead a vision through all of the politics and the power and the economics
yep.
that sort of surrounds a director like Martin Scorsese.
Yeah,
so.
Scorsese directed The Aviator, right?
Uh-huh.
And Rob was on that. Yeah,
that's
a friend of mine, we both went to architecture school together.
Nice.
And she went into art direction. She moved out here. She went to art direction. She actually originally is from Los Angeles. She went to art direction, and I was into architecture because, you know, architecture school, and then eventually moved into film. So when I came out here, I went to visual effects. So I remember her talking to me about Rob Legato because she was art direction on Aviator.
Mm.
So yeah, it was an interesting thing. And I guess Rob, as you know, he gets very involved as well. He does a lot of second unit directing.
Oh, he's a force of nature.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to find forces of nature
right.
that are not destructive. and I guess the inherent nature of being a force of nature is that you can create and destroy.
Yes.
So Rob, I guess, fits into both of those categories.
Yes. Yeah.
Where necessary, things get destroyed.
Yeah.
And where appropriate and as is expected, amazing things get created.
So how was your relationship with Rob started? How did that go?
You know, I remember, I think through our commercial work at the Syndicate, we ended up doing a commercial that he directed.
Okay.
And he liked that experience. And so he said, well, I have some stuff that I have to do for Marty. Why don't you have a hand in that too? And then
okay.
it just kind of grew to, we became sort of his go-to, He liked a sort of smaller approach to visual effects
uh-huh.
that was more hands-on, more working with artists on the box, less factory, less assembly line.
Yeah.
And so I think probably some of that comes from his previous experiences working on movies like Titanic,
yep.
where you built a giant piece of machinery to do some amazing stuff that had never been done before.
Right.
And so his style was a little bit more, everything ends up on the screen, all hands on deck. Oriented around physical production.
Mm-hmm.
So he had more of a physical production model for digital production.
Okay.
Which not many
people... Like a model-making kind of scenario, in a sense.
Yeah, or more just like a traditional physical production department. You got
sure.
a camera department, you
yep.
got, you know, props, you got sets, you got all... And so he looked at everything in sort of this time and materials model with everybody allied towards a final vision.
Right.
And so visual effects, interestingly, is designed the same way... but doesn't function economically the same way.
Yeah.
Like, we have the same departments. We have actors, we have
yes.
camera people, we have
mm-hmm.
Props, we have environments, we have lighting. All the same people that you find on a physical movie set, you find in the visual effects department. But for some reason, you know, that's a much longer conversation.
The efficiency goes out
running,
the window.
Yeah, well, we ended up running it like a completely separate thing
uh-huh.
rather than being fully integrated. And Rob was always sort of a champion of... it's the same thing. You're just doing it on a computer rather than doing it on a stage.
Yeah.
And the closer you can mesh those things, the better off you are. So Rob and large visual effects houses was never really a natural fit
yep.
in many cases because it made those things move very far apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the philosophy of the magic of the movie is made in context, you know, you look at old filmmaking, the director on set was fantastic about looking at the big picture with all the little pieces right in front of him, right there, rather than thinking
yep.
about making chess moves 8 to 10 months apart. And so you would make the movie in that moment.
Yeah.
And so you'd have momentum and you'd have creative momentum. And when you do visual effects 8 months later,
yeah.
then all of the reasons you intuitively made a decision on set... the way that you told a gaffer to move a light, the way that you told an actor to hit a mark, the way that you told a cameraman to be in the right place at the right time with the right lens and all that stuff,
yeah.
all those decisions a director makes in about 30 seconds
mm-hmm.
that are part of an instinctive vision that even he himself can't necessarily articulate,
yep.
that entire process evaporates when visual effects gets involved.
Yeah, and
so,
it takes the wind out of the sails.
Yeah, but it also results in... you know, a visual effects team that now has bad direction.
Yeah.
Because you're getting direction from somebody who's no longer in that moment, in that context,
yeah.
and they're now trying to remember what they were doing.
And they get reviews once a week. So once a week, it's like, okay, what was that shot? What was
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And no matter how great, and I've been fortunate to work with great people
yep.
on great projects. And that's kind of how I've tried to choose all of my projects is who do I get to work with?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fortunate to work even with great directors in that regard. And no matter how great the director, even I myself, as humble as I am in knowing how to do things,
yep.
like technically in the visual effects world, I have a hard time remembering what I did with the same exact shot a week ago.
Of course.
So the idea that I would be a director and be shown hundreds of shots in a given week and remember what I said last week about that shot, it's so dependent on what, you know, there's a team of artists who have been living that shot.
Right.
Nothing but that shot for months.
So they know exactly
so
what they're doing.
They go, why did you change your mind from last week? And you're like, man, out of 600 shots that I looked at between now and then,
right.
I don't even remember what I had for lunch that day.
And this is only a small portion of my day because I'm still dealing with editing and sound mixing and everything else.
Exactly. Yeah. So I never really blame the directors or the visual effects supervisors for being in that predicament. Ultimately, I blame ourselves for creating a process that takes them out of the momentum,
yep.
right? And it kind of goes back to how I got into visual effects in the first place, to be honest with you. I thought visual effects was something that I discovered it wasn't, and I have spent my entire career trying to move in the direction of what I thought it was before I got here.
Okay, so how I was going to go into how that transitioned into Hugo, but let's start back. Let's go back. So what got you into visual effects, and what made you think that where you wanted to go?
It's kind of a strange story.
Okay.
I was raised in Alaska.
Oh,
and
really?
And I was going to school for international politics.
Okay. So, in Alaska?
University of Alaska, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was my local hometown college.
Okay.
I grew up about 100 miles from there.
Uh-huh.
And so I was going to the University of Alaska.
Which is nothing in Alaska.
No, in Alaska, that's literally one stoplight.
Yeah.
So I was going to school for international relations, but I had to pay for college, so I was working as a photographer.
Okay.
So I worked for a local newspaper. And then I got a job as a cameraman at the local television station. And then I started to learn. I had already known how computers had worked since my dad put me on them in the mid-80s.
Right.
So I had computer experience. I learned how to edit. Got one of the first Avids in the state of Alaska. Started putting together a little bit of an informal production company that became a formal production department of a television station.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing evening news as a weatherman. So I was on green screen talking about what the weather was going to be in Alaska,
really?
Which is really easy. Yeah, it's always cold.
is it really?
It's pretty predictable, yeah.
Okay, I bet you it's less predictable than Los Angeles, though, right?
You know, it's funny. It's like the exact opposite of Los Angeles in that it's consistently predictably, you know, people just want to know when the cold snaps are.
Right.
That's the only thing to really talk about. Otherwise, you just have to be funny, which I kind of was. So it worked out. But anyway, I was doing that and I was paying for college, but that was always just a way to pay for school. My real job was international relations. I saw a movie that was called Wag the Dog.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw it because it was a political science movie.
And, now, okay.
I'm in Alaska. There's one movie theater for 400 miles.
Yes.
And so going to see the movies was not something I got to do very often. And mm-hmm. the selection of movies was not always the greatest. But I saw Wag the Dog because it was about political science. And I was like...
But they talk about visual effects in there.
Exactly. There's a scene. There's a famous scene, at least famous to me, where in the movie... I was going to school for political science because I wanted to, you know, have an impact on the world, change things, make the world a better place, whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I had a vision for how I was going to do that through politics and international relations. And then I saw Wag the Dog and I went, you know what? Maybe politics is a waste of time. Maybe I should get into the movie business and I should change public perception of the way the world works. And I was like looking at it, and on visual effects, there was this moment where they just did magical stuff.
And
they gave her a bag of chips and they turned it into a cat, and you could pick whatever cat you wanted. And they were also nonchalant about it. You know, they're sipping on their coffee cups while they click buttons that make, you know, war-torn villages appear and disappear and bombs and things like that. And I watched that and I was like, my God, I should just park this political science thing and I should go do that because that's much more of a cut to the chase Machiavellian kind of way to do it.
Such a great story because so many people get into visual effects because of Jurassic Park or whatever, but you got it because of the implication.
I got into it because of Wag the Dog.
Yeah. And but dude, that's so good and relevant today. Did you see the video that came out, I guess, this week or last week about the YouTube? Okay, so they take a YouTube of a famous political figure.
Oh, yeah.
You saw
the face remapping?
The face remapping.
Oh, yeah. No, I watch all this stuff because...
I know, because that is... The minute I saw that, and it was, and it's in my head so much because the virtual human stuff we're looking at is like, oh, my God, it's Wag the Dog.
Yeah.
It's totally like you can make say anyone say whatever they want.
Yeah. No, I... Believe me, I got down here. Uh-huh. I, you know, I came to L.A. I had an ex-girlfriend at the time who lived in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. So I came down and crashed on her couch.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I'll just take a look at what it would be like to get into the Hollywood business. Because I could shoot. I was like a cameraman. I knew how to like edit because I was an avid editor and I was an avid repair technician. Like I had all those skills, but I had no Hollywood awareness, right? So I got down here and I slept on her sofa for a long time. And eventually I had to get a job. So I registered with a temp agency.
Uh-huh.
And I got a job answering phones as a receptionist at a front desk at a talent agency for like a couple of days as one of my stints. And all of the people that worked at the talent agency were like, wow, you're like a little bit, you're not usually like, you know, usually we get actors who answer the phones, but you know how to fix computers and you know how to like get the printer to work and stuff like that. So they were like, you know, you should, what are you interested in doing? And I'm like, well, I can run camera. I can do editing. I can do all this other stuff. And I'm looking for a job. And they were like, well, you should try out visual effects. And I was like, really? Because that's actually one of the things I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, but I don't know how to get into visual effects. I don't know anything about how they do that, but it all seems very secretive and mysterious. And the woman, she goes, listen, let me let you in on a little Hollywood secret. Nobody knows how visual effects works.
Not even the people who do it.
It's some sort of black arts magic stuff that happens in a dark corner with mysterious people you never get a chance to meet. And she's like, but I know a guy. So I was like, okay, cool. Can you introduce me to this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And it was Bob Coleman at Digital Artist Agency.
Yep.
Right? So she's like, I can get you an introduction. And so I'm like, wow, I'm in the Hollywood system now. Like an agent is recommending me to another agent who represents visual effects artists. So I prep all my shit and I roll in there with like a DVD of all my previous work and like a really nicely color formatted like resume and then an accompanying digital PDF. And the PDF had an embedded QuickTime file that linked to my website. And at the time, these were all like amazing things that nobody could figure out because they were still using Microsoft Word.
And you had a VHS tape probably usually.
Yeah, as a backup. Right, exactly. And so I roll in there and Bob's like, look, this is great, but I can't possibly do anything with you in the visual effects world. You have no experience.
Right.
And like your work in Alaska looks neat and is fun and it's very cute, but like it's not, this is Hollywood. This is like, this is where all the stuff happens.
Right.
And you're not even close to that level. He's like, but I like the way you branded the whole thing. Like you did the DVD and you got the little resume. He's like, I don't even understand how this PDF is 200 kilobytes, but it somehow magically has a 3-minute demo reel in it. How did you even do that?
Right.
And so he said, here's what I'm going to do. If you want a job, I'll hire you to format the resumes of my visual effects supervisor clients and compress and edit their reels and help me build a website to represent my visual effects artists.
Really?
So that was my real start in the visual effects industry was
working for Bob.
Was polishing up people's resumes and building Bob's website and compressing their demo reels. And I said, okay, here's the deal. I'll do this for whatever minimum wage.
Yep.
But someday someone's going to call you for a job and none of your clients are going to be available. And whenever that day comes, I want you to just send me in for the interview, whatever it is.
Right.
And you can tell people you don't represent me or whatever, but just send me in. And so he's like, deal.
Okay.
So a couple months later, you know, somebody calls for an entry level roto position, roto paint. Bob's like, none of my clients are available, but I got this guy and I don't represent him. I don't represent him. Like I can't vouch for his skills or anything except I like him as a guy. So I'll send him in for the interview. And so I go in, and I don't even know if I gave them a chance to say anything. I walked in, I sat down, and I said, listen, I don't know how to do any of the stuff you guys are doing, but I believe in it 100%. And if at the end of a month I'm not totally fluent in whatever it is that you need and I'm not giving you exactly the experience that you desire, I will give you back all the money you gave me and we can part ways.
Okay.
No harm, no foul. So I think the two owners of the company just looked at each other and went, how do we say no to that?
Yeah.
And so I started, you know, the next day as a roto paint artist.
Okay.
So I did roto paint and I was like, okay, I'm going to build my way up to that day where I get to do the Wag the Dog stuff, right?
Right.
Because at the time I'm just literally, you know, that was when we used to like paint wires out of things one frame at a time, uh-huh. practically in Photoshop before there were any cool tools to do it. So what I found out right away after hanging out with everybody was visual effects didn't work at all like Wag the Dog. It was super time consuming and almost nothing was real time and everything was like an argument and a battle and all this stuff. And I was like, I was lied to.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, that pretty much
summed
up my...
Yeah, it's like the enhanced videos when you see in NCIS
or whatever. They're like, enhance, zoom in, enhance. And you're like, man, I want to get some of that technology.
Yeah, no, it doesn't exist.
So that's how I got into visual effects. And then I kind of like...
But you stayed with it.
Well, yeah, I've always sort of carried a chip on my shoulder about it because I've been like, God damn it, it should be like that.
Okay.
And so throughout every opportunity that I had, I told Bob, okay, here's the deal. This isn't what I expected at all, but I think that it could be someday. So why don't we do this? I didn't go to school for visual effects. Yep. I didn't like grow up as a kid thinking I wanted to be in visual effects, but I'm here.
Yep.
So let's just treat me like a disposable asset and put me in all the high risk situations. Because if I get kicked out of Hollywood for failing, then fine, I'll go do something else. I'll go to like Moscow State University and learn Russian. I don't care.
Right.
So that being the case, let's do some high-risk activities where most of Bob's clients were thinking strategically about their political careers. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I don't want to take that show because it's too risky. I can take this show and do a good job, and then the studio will like me, and then they'll put me on that show.
Make sure things I work for it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, things were much more strategic. I was like, if it's on fire or it's impossible or it doesn't look like it's going to succeed, then that's where I want to be.
Okay.
Because that's where I'm going to learn the most and the fastest. Because the other thing was like, if I wanted to get into camera or editing or all that stuff, those are union jobs.
Sure.
Where it takes 4 years to get into the union.
Yep.
And I was like, I'm disposable. Visual effects is non-union. It's the Wild West. Let's just go for broke and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. And I think, you know, when you went over to Pixamundo after Syndicate closed and you started working on Hugo and you kind of just like, fuck it, let's just figure it out, right?
Yeah, well, in a sense, that all happened in sort of the opposite order.
Right, okay.
I had always been freelancing because my goal was to get as much experience at as many different companies as possible.
Okay.
Rather than going to one company and learning how that, you know, really getting into the culture for a long period of time, I was like, I want to see all the stuff that's broken.
Mm-hmm.
Because people at different companies have great ideas that they don't share with each other. So if you travel around a lot, you learn a lot of great stuff.
Right.
So I had a chance to work with all kinds of talented people, uncharted territory, like Volker Engel and Mark Weigert were some of my earliest mentors.
Yeah.
I went to the orphanage. I worked with Stu Mashwitz and John Rothbart and all those guys. Learned a ton up there. You meet tons of great people in all these different companies, and not everybody has their shit together.
Right.
But everybody at least has one or two things that they do better than everybody else.
Sure.
So the more I could travel, the more I could get exposed to that stuff.
Right.
Syndicate and Cafe Effects, by extension, you know, we did some fun stuff. We had a great team, fantastic artists who have gone on to like be senior people at ILM and Digital Domain and all these other great companies from just this small little commercial shop in Santa Monica. We unfortunately were closed down like after Alice in Wonderland. So I was dating a girl who I later married, and I was like just trying to chill because I'd had such a long, you know, busy 10 years of jumping from one company to the next, of one crisis to the next, that I was like, you know what, I'm just going to smoke some pot, sit on the couch, and play video games for at least a week or two.
Yeah, just decompress.
And then, yeah, like I went to Thailand, I came back, and that's when my girlfriend said, hey, guess what, I'm pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, oh man, I now have no insurance, no job, and I only have enough money in my bank account to pay next month's rent.
And that's the first time you probably had to take a job by obligation, though, right?
It was like the first, I was like, well. So I was going to go to Digital Domain and start sniffing around for work because they were right down the block from where I lived.
Right.
And they had, they asked about a Michael Bay movie. Like, do you want to do this Michael Bay movie? And so I'd done all this work for Rob Legato. So I called Rob and I'm like, hey, you worked with Michael. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? And Rob was in London on Hugo, just in pre-production.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten the impression that, you know, the Hugo had to be done in London because it was a British show, and so there was no real chance for me to get on that project.
Gotcha.
And Rob said, actually, things are kind of complicated. Why don't you just get on a plane and come over here and help me figure some things out? And so I went, okay. I had been, you know, traveling around town and meeting lots of different people, but I obviously didn't have the money to buy a plane ticket. And when I talked to the producers there, they were like, we don't know who you are, but we're certainly not paying for a plane ticket for you to come visit us. So I called Tilo at Pixamondo.
Uh-huh.
And I never worked with him before.
Sure.
I'd only ever interviewed just to see what they were up to.
Right.
And I said, hey, there might be a chance that some work could come out of this trip to London on this movie Hugo. I have no idea what it is, but if you front me a plane ticket, I'll keep you in the loop about it.
Okay.
And so Tilo was like, all right, this is weird, but sure, I'll buy you a plane ticket to London. So I went to London.
Cool.
And figured out that movie was on fire. That movie needed some like serious get or done attitude,
right?
And some gluing the pieces together, because working with Marty is a somewhat particular and not necessarily mainstream approach to filmmaking, and they had all the pieces there to make an absolutely amazing movie.
Mm-hmm.
The script was amazing. The storyboards, I mean, from the original book were amazing. Everything right. was amazing. And it was a film about the pioneer of visual effects, you know?
Yeah.
Literally a movie about the pioneer of visual effects.
Yep.
And they didn't necessarily have all the pieces ready to get it done.
Mm.
And so I ended up sort of rallying all of the team of people that I'd ever worked with at any other company and said, we have to do this movie. We have to find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
And when we looked at the need and then we looked at the resources and we looked at what was required from the film, I was like, we need a company that has a global infrastructure, that has something to prove, that has a lot of potential and a lot of existing talent, but hasn't necessarily done this before.
Right.
So we're never going to run into the attitude of like, no, let us tell you how to make visual effects.
Sure.
And I thought, well, this really could just be a perfect storm for a Pixelmondo thing.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. We basically just said, look, here's the plan. We're going to have to make some new Pixelmondo offices, and we're going to have to take over existing ones, and we're going to have to build a whole new global pipeline, and we're going to have to, you know, do all these things that we've done at all these various little companies, but really transform this global shop that does all of this great different work into working like one company on a project like that.
Right.
And so it was heavy, man.
Yeah.
It was super heavy.
Yeah. I remember walking into the Santa Monica office, Pixamundo was like this whole, like, there was a lot of crap going on. It was, you guys are slammed on that.
No, it was a 24-hour-a-day job.
Yeah.
Because the work was always being done at some office in the world somewhere. And the cool part about having that much bandwidth is that productivity always keeps going, but so do the fires.
Right.
You know, so if you're familiar with any visual effects company, there's always something broken. There's always something on fire. And so if you have a company that is really like 12 or 14 different visual effects shops,
yep,
then you just always have fires.
Yep.
So you have to get into this totally different mindset. But the cool thing is that we started to structure the company and that project around Rob's early visions for how visual effects should work.
Yeah.
And we always have had a hard time shoehorning this visual effects is just digital production model into this visual effects is a separate post-production process that must be budgeted flat and broken out like this. And it was like, we always tried to get to a time and materials. And we, for all intents and purposes, operated that way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, we always had to shrink wrap our budgets when they went up to the final studio. And
because they just look at it as a big black box, and they're just like, okay, what is it going to cost? And,
well, it's too complicated for them to understand, which is partially our fault. But if we take away the ability for a producer to produce, you know, like the studio has producers who produce live action movies, so they can look at another live action producer and say, you are or are not doing a good job producing this movie.
Right.
But ultimately, they know physical production, so they go, look, lumber costs what lumber costs.
Right.
Nobody knows what pixels cost. So those guys...
or render time or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So those guys who work on that side of the equation, because they can't draw a parallel between the price of a 2x4 and the price of a single frame of video...
Right.
Then that's why they try to black box it, to just say, like, look, give me a flat number because I can't begin to expect to understand the complexity of what you're doing. So you're just going to bamboozle me at every turn.
Right.
So, I mean, down the road in later projects, we managed to make that process more transparent so that we were actually able to take physical production producers and get them to understand visual effects enough to produce it transparently.
Right.
And, you know, especially like some of the last stuff we did in visual effects was exclusively cost plus billing, where if a physical production producer client wanted to literally know how much a specific individual compositor on our crew cost, mm-hmm. they could see that very clearly. That person takes home this much money. They get this much in benefits, you know, insurance, fringe, all that kind of stuff. Okay. And we're paying this much in overhead and this much in margin.
Right.
And when we converted the business model in that sense, it was suddenly really weird because producers realized that they no longer were just blindly negotiating a flat budget to get it 20% lower, blindly trying to save money. They were able to make strategic, logical decisions about how they produce the film, even in the digital production.
And do you think they have the capability of actually doing that?
At first, no. The first time you look at it, everybody gets confused. But then but then once they start to realize, like, oh, these are real people who do real jobs, just like the other real
we're
people
not just gonna
that I'm used to producing.
20% less, and then maybe that company goes under.
That's right. That's exactly what everybody was doing.
Right.
And I totally understand why. Like, I empathize with them because I was physical side, or I was production side for a couple of times.
Right.
I saw how it works.
Yeah.
And I managed other vendors, and I was just
that's
like,
why they have unions, and this is what it costs.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, man, I feel you.
Yeah.
But I can't just lay all the blame at the studio's shoulders 100% of the time, because from their perspective, you can't just shovel money into a black hole not knowing what it's actually happening at. So you have to make it, you have to make the concepts of digital production, which is AKA visual effects, you have to make them approachable using the idea of physical production as a metaphor. Once you do that, then everybody starts to get it. And I've actually found, like, at first everybody freaks out. I go, hey, look, we don't work, I'm not going to flat bid this stuff. I'll budget it for you. Exactly the same way that you would budget a physical production.
Right.
And then I'll give you...
This is how many hours of compositing you need. And
I'll give you contingency allowances. Mm-hmm. I'll build all this stuff in using a standard, whether it's an AICP form, or whether it's like a Producers Guild, you know, standard approach to filmmaking and budgeting.
Right.
But I will do that with digital production, not physical. And then at first you will freak out because you've never done visual effects that way. And then about 1 month into doing it, you'll be like, this is the greatest thing ever. And why did we ever do it any differently?
Right.
And so I've even...
You're transparent, basically.
Yeah, exactly, because I'm not... I'm doing what you want.
Yeah.
I'm not stealing money from you and hiding it somewhere.
Yeah.
This is the thing that you asked for, and here's how much it cost. Would you like more of those things or less of those things? But we can stop talking about money and start talking about creative.
Right.
Because now it's just like every other part of the process.
I know. Okay, people laugh at me, but I said, you know, when I was, you know, souping at... Method and Sway and places like that, they asked me, it's like, so, you know, what's my favorite part of the process is the bidding time. And the reason it is if, okay, I've told this story before, but I hope you'll appreciate it, is that someone comes up to me, director says, I want to do this crazy thing and I have $4, right?
Yeah.
And I said, okay. Well, let's see what you want to do first before we get to the budget part. It's like, okay, to do that the way you described it, literally, this is going to cost, you know, $150. And it's like, but I only have four. It's like, okay, well, let's see. What do you really want to do? And then it's like, well, what I really want to do is this. I want to, and it's like, okay, so maybe, you know, if we do it this way, then we can do it for like $12.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And so suddenly what happens, that we're actually having a creative conversation now. The conversation has changed because I can actually explain how things get done, and they get really interested in that, as opposed to just going to some other place that says, we'll do it for $4. It doesn't matter if we'll go under, but we'll do it for $4. Like, that's not creative.
Yeah.
And so I
Well, no, because then you spend the entire rest of the process trying to cheat the creative.
Right.
And I hate that. I hate that so much. And that's one of the very fortunate things about working with Rob and Marty, mm-hmm. is that cheating and lying gets you killed immediately. Like, it doesn't matter, anybody in that circle, anybody on that process, any hanky-panky, mm-hmm. and you're a dead man.
Yep.
Like, just immediately, thank you, here's your paycheck, see you later, you're never coming back. Like,
okay.
Everything is about honesty, even if it's brutal on occasion.
Yeah.
And as long as everybody is allied towards making the greatest movie possible, then you're okay, and you can walk into the fiery ovens of hell knowing that the entire production supports you, because they know that that is your sole intention. You're not there for fame, you're not there for glory, you're not there to get rich, you're there to make the greatest movie that anyone's ever seen.
Uh-huh.
And in a lot of other movies that I've seen or have been a part of, politics is and fortunately I went to school for it, but politics is a much bigger player that I just don't like, and it typically surrounds the money, right?
Of course.
So if the money is getting allocated poorly or spent poorly, then drama and politics and bullshit ensues, and then the movie the movie ultimately pays the price. Yes. The viewer in the theater who watches the screen
this is crappy getting and I don't shafted. Know why. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're like, they don't get it. And people say like, oh, visual effects is not really like someday they'll be capable of doing photoreal. No bullshit. Yeah. That's not a visual effects problem. We've been capable of doing photoreal damn near anything for at least a decade. Yeah. If you see bad visual effects now, that's bad producing.
Right.
That means that somebody, that means that somebody said that they could do something they couldn't for an amount of money that they couldn't or with resources that they couldn't.
Yep.
And sometimes that's because they were too optimistic a thinker, but usually it's because somebody didn't understand the process well enough and just tried to grind it
down. I'm going to use that quote. Bad visual effects is bad producing.
It is. Yeah. Now, these days. In the old days, we were trying to do the impossible, right?
Of course. So we were way beyond our head.
And sometimes the only way to find out that it was truly still not possible was to just give a shot at it. Right. And so I really, and I say this partially.
And the problem is that the good visual effects, if it's good, then you don't even know it's there. So
yeah. Well, that's my point, too, is that when people say, like, oh, I see all these bad visual effects. Yes, you see bad visual effects. What you don't see is amazing visual effects. And there are metric fuck tons of amazing visual effects in your everyday life. Entire shows are visual effects you don't even realize have visual effects.
Yep.
And that is great visual effects. You see bad visual effects, so you complain about bad visual effects. Yeah. But it is like sort of an unfortunate thing to go back and look at all these movies that flopped or had terrible visual effects and say, why did that happen? Mm-hmm. And when you really get into the conversations with people, you realize it's because somebody said yes the wrong way. And this is an important distinction.
They agreed to something that they really couldn't pull off.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I've been called out on it a few times and I don't think I've ever lost, but I've got this philosophy of saying yes, where I feel like
The same thing you just told me about where you get a job. It's like, yeah, I can do it. I don't know how, but I'll figure it out.
Exactly. So I've had that philosophy of saying yes. Now, what I've realized over time is that it's not always just as simple as saying yes. Sometimes you actually have to be able to, you know, some problems are so hard you can't just say yes and then brute force your way through it. So the art of saying yes is about sometimes changing the question.
Okay.
So let me go this direction with it. You can always say yes, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that you aren't going to change the question when you say yes, because they may say, can you do this? And you say, yes, I can do that. If that is altered in the following ways, right? Because that will be, and these things are going to be risky and we're going to pursue them, but we might fail. And if we fail, here's our backup plan. And if we fail that, here's our other backup plan.
Yep.
But you can always find a way to say yes. What's interesting to me is that there are personalities and companies and people and teams whose job is to say no. Like, if you say, like, yo, can I do this? No. Well, go. Okay. And then you spend all this time hammering on them until you find out that ultimately, yes, you can. The attitude was just no.
Right.
Yes, they could do that work, but they just kept saying no.
Right.
And so that makes it really frustrating. I think that as you look around the company that we're in today, you see a lot of people whose answer is yes. Okay. They may change the question, but the answer is, God damn it, yes.
Yes.
We're going to figure out a way to do that, even if it's never been done before. So being attracted to those impossibilities and finding a way to say yes, even if it means changing the rules of the game, is like an important thing to be honest about. And that's how you work with, you know, people like J.J. Abrams or people like Rob Legato and Martin Scorsese and like all these big projects. Is you're a person who can solve problems and finds a way to say yes.
Let's figure it out.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that's part of the journey, and that's already excitement. And if you go down that journey with them, I don't know. I feel that a lot of times it's like, okay, how many shots, how many this, how many lighting, and it's just not as exciting when you go like, oh crap, we got a problem, we got to solve, we got to figure something out, and I know that's obviously that's something that you've always been passionate about, and you were telling me earlier, it's like I'm kind of taking a little bit of a sabbatical from visual effects right now, right?
Yeah,
you're doing other crazy shit right now, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, you bring up a good point. I mean, to a certain extent, over time, I think I sort of evolved this addiction in the visual effects industry to the impossible.
Right.
Because that was exciting. Mm-hmm. Right. You're like, as soon as somebody says, hey, we got this little movie and it's never been done before, I'm all ears.
Yeah.
I'm all in. And as a matter of fact, like a lot of the people that I've been surrounded with had that same sort of attitude. They're like, oh, this can't be done. That's great. That's all we care about now is something that can't be done.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the reason one of, you know, I kind of hate to call it out, and I'm sorry for anyone who I did, but the reason I quit Sony is that when I was working on Ghost Rider, a terrible movie, but I loved working with Kevin Mack because he was an awesome, awesome guy.
Yeah. Right?
And and Kevin is a wonderful person, and I really was admired him. And they interview me, he's like, we want to put you as a lighting supervisor on Spider-Man 3. We've heard you're a really amazing lighter. It's like, great. And he goes, well, all right, tell me what's going to happen. What's new? It's like, nothing's new. We're not going to reinvent the wheel. If it ain't broken, we're not going to fix it. It's just going to use our standard normal. And I said, fuck it, I'm out. You know,
yeah.
I'm not going to work on something. It's like, I just went through 9 months of boring pipeline. That's exactly the same crap that's always been done in visual effects. No offense. I mean, it was fine, whatever. But yeah. I want to make some interesting things. I want to break shit. You know?
No, there needs to be some sort of there needs to be some sort of impossibility to overcome. And I will tell you this. Part of the reason why I'm taking a sabbatical from visual effects is that we solved all of the impossibilities in visual effects. The only one that hasn't truly, masterfully, gracefully been solved, like beyond a shadow of a doubt, is digital humans.
Okay.
So I looked at that and I went, okay, I'm either going to do nothing but digital human work now.
Uh-huh.
Or
speaking to,
like, are there any other problems? Right. And I'm super passionate about it, but I will be honest, I'm not particularly adept at or skilled at it.
Sure.
Because my background in visual effects has never oriented me along the lines of being a masterful shader or animation oriented person.
I don't think anyone is. We can talk about this more.
But I'm very passionate about it. But when I looked at what's left in visual effects, like what are the things that I can at least help check off the list,
mm-hmm.
It's really just time and budget. And so I took a stab at that with the guys here and the girls, and we all said, okay, look, we're going to put our heads together. We're going to find a way to make time and budget better. And then we did the last two movies, which was like Hugo and Star Trek, which were really like massive time and budget impossibilities.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't know how, but somehow they all were, and all movies are. And what I realized was like, okay, we'll make some efforts towards solving the time and budget thing, but it's really hard to be motivated to get up before the sun and go to sleep long after the sun
mm-hmm.
to solve budget and schedule problems that you don't have any participation in, right? Like, I didn't create this problem, and I don't benefit from solving it.
Right.
But somehow there's a gun to my head and it's my job to fix your budget and schedule mm-hmm. problem, which was the result of you being too important to think about all the details of what you're doing in the filmmaking process.
Right.
So it's hard to motivate.
Just to say, just go to Vancouver and you'll save 30%. Right?
Well, that's ultimately what people were doing.
Right.
And, you know, then what happens is you get this natural and inherent sort of backlash from different geographic regions of the world against other different geographic regions of the world. And I'm like, look, you can't take this like North American versus, you know, Asian approach or European versus Canadian or whatever.
Right.
It's not helpful. And one of the greatest things about working at Pixelmondo was that I fell in love with all of the visual effects artists around the world. So when people were like, we need to burn down the Oscars and we need to burn down the visual effects community and we need to like boycott, I'm like, you don't understand. You can't. It's not your industry.
Yep.
It's the global industry.
Yep.
And I love working with all of those people. And I've loved working with artists in China, not just Beijing, but Shanghai and many other places. And I've loved working with them in Thailand and with, you know, all the different places in Germany and Europe and France and like all these great people that I've been fortunate to work with around the world. It's a global problem. If we have a problem, you cannot take a geographic.
No. And a lot of people who are attack or get defensive about, you know, their subsidies. It's like, you're that way because you want everything to be in Los Angeles. Like, absolutely not. I just don't want to have to move every 6 months, and I don't want to have to do that. And that's nothing, not a problem. It's like, in fact, international is. When I was at Digital Domain, I was the only American in a room of six. Everyone else was on visas. And why is that? The reason is because if you're working on big visual effects stuff, crazy stuff, you have to hire the best people in the world, not in the United States, not in California, not in Los Angeles, in the world. So you hire people from around the world to do it.
Yeah.
And or open offices around the world, whatever it is. I mean, I remember with Pixelmondo, I'd worked with them when I was at Digital Domain. We were working on Oblivion, right?
Yeah.
And they did a bunch of stuff on Oblivion too. It was kind of almost half and half.
First of all, let me just apologize. If there was ever any bad experience working with Pixelmondo on Oblivion, that was my fault on Hugo or on Star Trek.
Probably.
Because I was always I was always trying to be as polite as I could, but stealing resources from them at every turn.
Okay, so we had, there was a, I guess, you know, obviously you have people around the world, but the guys that were in Stuttgart and were incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And they were doing some amazing work. And I was like, obviously they gave them a sequence. And I was like, whoa, that is beautiful. And I was like, I certainly didn't resent them from being in Stuttgart. In fact, they're incredible. In fact, they continue to work. I think there's a lot of them were working
MacaVision.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. and they did incredible work on Game of Thrones. Obviously, they did it when they were at Pixelmondo as well. And they should be celebrated for all that work. And I think Stuttgart, which I'm going to go there soon, so hi, Stuttgart, does has incredible talent in visual effects.
Oh, dude. Yeah, well, they have the Film Academy there.
They have the Film Academy there.
And but to be honest with you, too, like, it's funny. Every visual effects shop in the world builds a culture, right?
Sure.
The culture of a visual effects company is the single most valuable thing, right?
Okay.
Like, I've gone to a million different companies, and sometimes people think, like, our technology and our pipeline. You know, like, companies like Scanline would be like, it's our pipeline and our technology. And it's like, well, okay. In brief flashes in the pan, yes.
Okay.
Like, you may have a competitive advantage in this or that at any moment in time, but that competitive advantage erodes within a year, right? Mm-hmm. So the culture is the culture of a company is the thing that persists.
Yes.
And so it was interesting to be at a company like Pixelmondo, and there are other companies like this, I'm sure, where you have multiple different offices that have been raised or have evolved in different ways. Mm-hmm. So they have different cultures, which means that they have different capabilities. Sometimes those cultures are built around a personality, like one person who is particularly remarkable and exceptional, or it could just be the city. And I found that, like, and working at a place like Pixelmondo, I had the ability to start to profile countries, cultures, and people.
Okay.
And start to identify what was making a visual effects team particularly great.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you would look at something and go, wow, the guys in Stuttgart doing amazing work. I'm looking at that entire company and saying, okay, for this particular task on this particular shot, I need to send that to Shanghai. And this particular task on that particular shot, I need to send that to Frankfurt.
But
this,
it's like you're dealing with like 17 different visual effects companies.
Yeah,
and you're like,
but
and
in
each
sense,
one has their own little skill set. And
but in a sense, it's like dealing with 17 different people. Right?
Okay, yeah.
Because a company's culture is like, to an outsider, acts like the person. It becomes a person.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, like, I'm going to send this to Sven in Frankfurt, and mm-hmm. I'm going to send that to Johnny in Berlin, mm-hmm. and this is going to go to London, and it's because the personalities or the culture of the companies lends itself very well to an expertise in that particular thing.
Gotcha.
And so what you realize is, like, then you come back to America and you work on just like a simple one little shop where everybody, you realize it's the exact same thing.
Yep.
The people in that shop are not all Americans.
Nope.
They're all different personalities. They're all different people from around the world. And even if they are all Americans, mm-hmm. it works just like it does on the global scale.
Yeah.
With different companies. It's kind of weird, but you develop this sort of, you know, this abstraction layer between geographic boundaries. And then things like tax incentives. Tax incentives are something that are like fireworks that distract from what's actually going on.
Uh-huh.
Because you just throw a bunch of money at something and it creates an artificial economy.
Right.
And that doesn't, it's sort of weird. It's like an outside external force, and it's temporary in some cases, and it's overpowering in other areas.
Right.
I don't think the visual effects companies are necessarily profiting from all
that.
No,
they're
not.
The only thing they're profiting is they're actually have the ability to get the work.
That's right.
As long as you go to this location, then we'll give you the work.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's kind of sad to do that, but that's fine. And I understand that the movie industry has a huge demand for big budget movies that they don't necessarily want to spend that money on, and they need to be able to profit. And they're, because they're making so many movies, they're risking a lot more.
Yeah.
And by minimizing that risk, by spending less money, they can do it. And the way they're doing that is being incentivized by profit.
Well, and also to minimize the risk that is inherent in trying to save money, because we all know of movies that tried to save too much money, right?
Yes.
And failed as a result of that.
Yep.
In order to try and minimize the risk of minimizing your risk by minimizing your capital exposure, people like to hedge and sort of diversify the project across multiple different offices or multiple different companies. Because if one company starts to go under, then they can just shift their weight to another company.
Yep.
And you see this throughout history on big high-risk visual effects projects where, you know, we had this problem on Hugo too, where production was like, I don't like that one company is doing this work. I want more companies involved. And my answer was, that's great, but more companies involved does not equal more capability. It also doesn't diversify your risk. Essentially, at Pixelmondo, we are a diversified hedge fund of risk where I have, you know, 12 or 14 different offices working on this movie. So I am diversifying your risk. You just don't like that I'm collectively bargaining on behalf of all of them.
Right.
And you want to break the show up into multiple companies so that you can negotiate prices with them individually. That's a different thing than minimizing your VFX risk.
Right.
And so in that particular case, we said, okay, look, I understand. If Pixamondo, for some reason, wakes up one day and decides, oh my God, we're going to go bankrupt and takes your whole movie with it, you need to have some kind of pressure valve. Right. So you need to have other companies involved.
Yep.
So fine, we'll keep two other companies in the loop on sequences who are also doing great work and are also capable of great things. Yep. But we'll have that opportunity there for you, even if only as a symbolic gesture of comfort.
Okay.
But ultimately, the thing that I discovered was you go through these phases of who to hate. When you're an artist, like I'm a rotopaint, and like when I was rotopaint or when I was a match mover, it was like I would hate the person who was responsible for telling me my work wasn't good enough.
Right.
And then I would realize they're right. My work wasn't good enough.
Sure.
So now I hate the person who is telling them. And then you kind of hate your way up the ladder. Mm-hmm. And now you one day, once you finally stop hating the studios, mm-hmm. you do so because you realize that the studios are run by people mm-hmm. and the people keep their jobs based on the performance of their business unit, and the performance of their business unit is judged solely by one person, the American people or the shareholders at large.
Right.
So if you were looking at this American corporation, it'd be the American people. But a company that is publicly held is owned by the shareholders.
Yep.
And so if you want to hate on somebody, hate on the shareholders.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, guys like, you know, any of your studio executives that everybody likes to rail against. Yeah. And I like Chris DeFaria the most on that in that regard because he takes the damage so well. He's like, look, I'm just going to tell you, I'm passionate about visual effects. I'm passionate about this industry. And Chris takes huge risks on amazing things like Gravity, mm-hmm. you know, which like probably wouldn't have existed except for a guy like him. And he takes all this damage from above and below, but he's at least honest about why the system works that way. Right. And people just don't listen to him generally, but that whole shareholders thing, once I realized that, I was like, okay, well, I can't hate everybody. So I guess it's time to just stop being angry.
Sure, and start trying to fix the problems. Yeah. Well, first of all, you're doing something very different now, right?
Now, yes. Now now I've decided to like say, I'm going to take a little bit of a sabbatical from visual effects.
Right.
And I kind of started to do it before this whole VR and AR thing really happened, but it was coincidentally around the same time. So now,
tell people what you've done at this point.
Sure. Well, I've been.
But if we know how we got here now. Yeah.
Well, I got very lucky to be able to get a bunch of people that I and the other people that I've worked with have loved working with for a long time and get some money behind the idea that we could bring experiences outside of the movie business and go beyond just the traditional theatrical rectangle and create experiences that either exist in the real world or in specific locations to say what kind of experiences live beyond movie theaters and mm-hmm. beyond video games. And we had that sort of philosophy, like we're not exactly sure what all that stuff is, but we're going to find out. Because if you look back at the sort of track record of what we were doing, if I go back to like Alice in Wonderland is one of the first 3D movies that we ever worked on.
Okay.
You know, and in the process of doing that from guys like Corey Turner, we learned a lot about what stereoscopic filmmaking does to the audience and how to control that. And that was like a very rudimentary exposure to, here's a sort of artistic yet scientific way to manipulate how the audience sees something and understands a story and connects with characters and all that kind of stuff. So we were like, on the next movie, which was Hugo, Marty gave us the power to take that into overdrive. So we really were like testing people, experiences, and manipulating stereo values to make people have emotional responses. So that if I was to show you the same shot or what you would think is the same shot, you would feel differently about it based on the stereo values that we put into it.
Okay.
Should I wait for the?
No, that's fine. Okay. I mean,
there's a visual effects show delivering down the street, so that's why you can hear the sirens. So on Hugo, we spent a lot of time exploring and discovering, like, oh, you know what? Here are all these things that make the audience emotionally connect with the image that are somewhat technical in nature.
Okay.
And here's, you know, every movie is a learning process. Here's what we're learning. We're learning that in order for people to feel like something is real, stereo is important.
Yeah.
High frame rate is important. High dynamic range is important. Why are these things important? They're important because they emulate the human experience more closely.
Okay.
So then you start to go, okay, if high frame rate and moving, you know, as Doug Trumbull has informed us all, moving beyond 60 frames a second at least,
yes,
gives you the sense that you can no longer perceive that something has that on-off staccato motion that Muybridge knows so well.
Mm-hmm.
If you get stereo values now, okay, you're starting to get something that your brain says like, oh, okay, this is a more immersive and realistic experience. If you get high dynamic range, which by that I mean your eyes and pupils now have a more active role in dilating, yep, to accommodate a broader range of, yep, of brightness and more detail in shadows, yeah, things start to behave more like the real world. Okay, you're taking baby steps closer and closer and closer to an experience that the human body says, okay, this is legit.
Mm-hmm.
But something that we discovered on Hugo, and I mean, look, you discovered it on every project that you worked on that's 3D, is that stuffing all that into a rectangle sucks because it's not designed for that. And 3D breaks as soon as you hit the edges of the frame. And there's all these tricks that we do to, yeah, try and minimize.
You try to make it like a window.
And, yeah, there's all these things you can do. But no matter what you do, you are always going to run into things like for example, on Hugo, we knew this for sure. Depth of field. Like, if you really want to make a great 3D movie, you can't make a great 2D movie. Period. End of discussion. Anybody, I don't care who they are, anybody who says you can simultaneously make a good 3D movie and 2D movie either is lying to you or just doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
Because for people to have a truly natural and immersive experience in 3D, their eyes need to be responsible for what is in focus. And, yep, if a cinematographer
makes that decision
for them based on optical technology, yeah, aka light through a lens focused on a film plane, then the viewer is like taken out of the experience in ways that they can't articulate because it's subconscious.
Right.
And so little things like that become a problem. We look at the situation, we go like, well, to shoot stereo movie, you need two cameras and you got to probably use a beam splitter because cameras are so big and, mm-hmm, the IO can't be too big. And you start adding up all these things and trying to solve these problems and you realize, you know what? I don't think this stuff can actually get there. Because, mm-hmm, at the end of the day, I'm trying to create, or we collectively are trying to create, something that emulates the human experience in order to drive a stronger emotional connection. And we cannot do that in a group experience, in a theater, in a rectangle, beyond the limits of what has been done, essentially, right?
Yeah.
So around that
I think
that
we're still obsessed with the movie theater phenomena. I think, to be honest, I think that has been... If there's something that the movie industry has to do is needs to break away from the theater experience.
It would be an interesting thing. And let me just say I'm not dissing movie theaters,
no,
theatrical experiences,
different things,
movies.
Different, yeah, things.
But much in the same way that opera exists today,
right,
and theater exists today, and people still tell stories around campfires. Cinema, as we know it, will always continue to exist.
In that form. Yep.
But if you want to try and evolve in this particular line of emotional
connection...
But
we really don't tell that many stories around campfires anymore, do we?
Well, you might not go camping very often, but the people who go camping tell stories,
sure,
around campfires.
I mean, well, to be in a sense, what we're doing right now is kind of like that, right?
Well, Facebook is.
Right, Facebook is.
Facebook is a perfect place where in today's 30-second attention span, you can vomit out some information and then everybody can shit on it or laud it or comment on it or laugh about it.
Right.
And that is... Facebook is stories around a campfire.
Yeah,
the campfire
I see
just happens
that.
To be
I see that, absolutely.
So... So we share stories, you know, I find some stupid link that I found somewhere and I put it on there and then I say something snarky about it and then a bunch of people like either laugh or cry and then people argue and fight and, you know, I mean, you only have to like look at the current state of American politics on Facebook,
uh-huh,
to see what, you know, we're still doing basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Point is that in the movie business, you know, theaters will probably continue to exist for quite some time.
Yep.
And that is a valid and valuable and important form of the broader scope of what is storytelling, right?
Yep.
And I don't think that as we move into virtual reality and augmented reality, I don't think that this is going to replace filmmaking. I think it will be in addition to a different kind of filmmaking when it gets figured out.
Yeah.
Or a different kind of storytelling when it gets figured out.
Well, right? I think that's the billion-trillion-dollar question is, can we figure out storytelling in an environment that's virtual? Because I don't know if we can, and this is a huge part of what I've been trying to study and figure out. And I love the idea of it. I mean, I talked to who is it? Alex McDowell a little bit.
Oh, sure.
And he's, that's
no, that's his thing.
That's his thing.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk to him more about it and figure it out, because I think that's the idea, is like, a lot of people is like, hey, I love this movie, you should make a VR thing of it. And I was like, what? That's two different things. That's,
so what you're getting at, and being on sabbatical from visual effects, I've been blessed with some time to think deep thoughts sure. about stuff. What you're talking about to me is this concept of storytelling versus story experience.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so if you can accept that these are related and similar yet distinct things, then suddenly VR and movie theaters make sense.
Yes.
Because storytelling is
like third person.
You and I may have a very similar experience. We might go whitewater rafting and we might be in all the same places and all the same times, but my experience will be totally different than your experience, and you might be totally bored and mine will have been somehow revolutionary and life-changing.
Sure.
Right? That's a possibility. And it might be because the way I think about things that I experience might have been somewhat superior to yours
yeah.
when it comes to sharing that experience with everybody else.
Right.
Case in point, Martin Scorsese is a better director than blah, 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 blah. You just pick it and he's probably a better director.
Sure.
He's a better storyteller. VR is not about storytelling. It's about story experiencing.
Right. It's like you going on a white water trip.
Yeah. So it's a different sort of thing, but not. So I guess what I'm saying is that this is where we ran into this like mental glitch, and why a bunch of us, to be honest with you, if you look around Magnopus right now, there are a lot of really talented visual effects people here who aren't doing visual effects anymore.
Right.
And it's because we were sort of simultaneously hitting creative problems and solving them, and solving technical problems. And the technical problems that we were solving enabled creative problems. And so we were in this loop, and that's when we ran out of capability in the theatrical realm.
Yes.
So we were like, hey, we can't make the theatrical experience necessarily any significantly better. And we're starting to get out of storytelling and into story experiencing. What is that? Is there a way to still be a storyteller when the audience is as active as the director? And I believe that that's possible. I believe that from all the things that I've seen in the last couple of years,
I'm not,
it won't be the same as a film.
I'm not downing it, and I'm not. Yeah. I'm not. I certainly don't want people saying that I'm poo-pooing the idea of VR and story, because I haven't found what it is, right? And it's just the same.
No one's done it, right?
Where everyone's been joking. It's like we're like the Lumiere brothers right now, where everyone's running out of the theater. It's like I almost got hit by a train, right? So, yeah. But at that time, when the Lumiere brothers first showed things, they didn't know what editing was. They didn't know how to tell a story in any kind of way. In fact, the invisible style was something that we have become accustomed to so much second nature, right?
Sure.
So, but back then, they're like, they didn't know how to tell a story with editing, right?
No, it was documentary. You were capturing a moment, and then you were allowing people to experience that moment from a perspective. And it
right.
was only when you started to evolve cinema into, yep. I am telling you a story from a perspective.
Yeah.
And you will now start to see my fingerprint on everything in this experience, to that you get to the point where you have auteur filmmakers who mm-hmm. are like, I recognize this story, even if I don't know it's from this director. Yep. I recognize this from that director, and you start to get to that point of storytelling, it's much more advanced.
But I think that's the problem I have sometimes, is that I think, and you know, a lot of people are just trying to adapt filmmaking to this scenario, and I don't think that necessarily always works. And so like I say, it's like, what's a close-up in VR? It's just you awkwardly close to someone, and that feels uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When technically what a close-up is supposed to allow you to feel the emotion of that person.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, different.
Well, okay. So, you know, long lenses, wide lenses, all of these things are tools that filmmakers use to cut to the chase, right?
Right.
And because they can only use sound and picture, and this is an important distinction,
uh-huh.
because filmmakers can only use sound and picture to convey a message,
mm-hmm.
and that picture can be modified through all of the ways that we know.
Yep.
And I should show you a chart I made someday, because I went down a rabbit hole on this. And we have a nice little chart that sort of like connects all of these little pieces. Because you can only use those two things, I can't raise the hair on the back of somebody's neck and give them a second sense realization that they forgot something that will cause them to look at, you know, the knife on the table that is, you know, an important pivotal part of the story. I can only do that with lensing. I either use the sound of a knife hitting the floor to draw your attention to it, or right. I take a long lens and I feature that thing narratively or editorially.
Sure.
In VR, the question is not what is a close-up in VR? The question is, what is a close-up in real life?
Right.
And then you'll know what it is in VR. Yeah. So if you only ever if you stop thinking about things as VR and you start thinking about things just as real life, what is a close up in real life?
Like, yeah.
It could be a variety of things. It could be somebody telling you something is important. It could be you remembering in your own head that something is important.
Yeah, in fact, you have to rely on the actual content way more.
Exactly. And so it becomes in truth, it becomes about this concept that didn't exist before called context.
Okay.
Because you may as a person in real life, you may see a series of things, places, objects, people, whatever, that builds a narrative in your mind that allows you to leap forward into the future and draw a conclusion. Like, yeah. Because I have seen this person's eyes moving furtively,
mm-hmm.
and because I have seen that the kitchen drawer where the silverware is slightly open, and because I can vaguely see the hint of a knife handle over there, and I maybe see a puddle of red coming from around the corner, I am drawing the conclusion that something has happened, right? So you build this narrative in your head, and then that gives you an excitement to realize what has not yet been manifest in your experience.
Right.
That is storytelling in real life for you as an individual. You put those pieces together yourself. Virtual reality just needs to make those same things available to you, and you yourself must become so comfortable. And by comfortable, I mean headsets, goggles, gloves, suits, whatever the hell it is, that whatever the crap is that we're going to put on people to get them into virtual reality, you have to make that all invisible to their perception eventually.
Sure.
So that they can't feel it or they're not aware of it anymore. And then they can start to have a replication of real life. And what is storytelling, and whether or not it is storytelling or story experiencing, like, you could go back to movies in the 80s. Like,
okay.
You could go back to movies in the 90s, Strange Days. Like, mm-hmm. people are buying experiences from other people that are themselves stories, and they are jacking into them using, like, neural shunts or whatever sort of brain fiction technology they had back then.
Brainstorm.
Yeah.
Directed by Doug Trumbull.
Exactly. what a coinkydink.
Yeah, exactly.
But you have things like that are already sort of outlining where we're heading.
Yep.
And you know, it's not insignificant that we talk about neural shunts or directly interfacing with the human brain, because I think we can all agree that is the next step.
Sure.
We just are rather infantile at how we're doing that right now.
I think, I'm not trying to be negative, because it's not that. I just think that there's so much misinformation that's out there, and I'd love to be able to cut through the BS, which is great, but it is an exciting time. And it would not be an exciting you would not be doing what you're doing now if it's not an exciting time. And I can sense when I walk through this office, whoa, even just from just like, this is exciting. I can sense the excitement, and it's very palpable. It's like, I was excited. I just texted Law, and I mean, I guess, like, I don't even know what they're doing, but I'm in.
well, we don't know what we're doing either.
Yeah.
But figuring it out.
But okay, so we're actually, believe it or not, we're already at an hour.
Oh, wow.
But I'd love for you to give a good summary for people. Is like, okay, because you're, like you said,
if I could do that, I'd have more investors.
Your website is a little vague, and you said for a reason, because you're trying to make sure that you're keeping yourself open into a bunch of ideas. But what is it that you guys are actually doing
here? Okay, so you pointed out a very good and important observation, because you are a smart person who actually understands all the technology behind this. So when people say things, you can say, that's a lie.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the industry right now, I would say that 75% of it is lies.
Yes.
People who have good intentions, but aren't smart enough to really know that what they're saying isn't true.
Yes.
There are quite a few people who are very smart and who are doing really amazing work in virtual reality and augmented reality, but they are vastly outnumbered by the number of people who just know enough to be dangerous.
Yes.
And by dangerous, I mean seek venture capital that will whip this whole world up into a frenzy of false expectations.
Right now, and VR it's a .com, right? It's like, I got a thing.
Quite possibly worse than a .com.
Yeah.
Because now the technology enables something so much more. See, .com was about newspapers.
Yes.
Check it out.
Yeah.
The internet right now is a newspaper.
Yes.
It is words and pictures, generally speaking, in two dimensions, and you read and look at them.
Yep.
That is fundamentally what 95% of the content on the internet is. Now, you get into the Internet of Things, and you get into the cloud, and you get into abstracting computing, and you get all kinds of these other things going on, and you're... I just realized we're not getting any closer to answering your question. But you're enabling all kinds of different perceptions of what the internet is. And fundamentally, in those times, the internet was a newspaper.
Sure.
And now what we're trying to do is say, forget the internet. There is a thing called, let's just say, the metaverse. It is a digital copy of the universe that we know. And so now we have a virtual copy of the physical world.
Yep.
And we can alter the virtual copy to suit our needs.
Right.
So if you don't have legs, we can change that.
Yep.
In the metaverse, you can have legs.
Yes.
You can run. You can fly. You can travel to different countries. Yep. You can speak different languages that don't even exist. You can put yourself in an environment where you're not even aware of what your own race is anymore. So all of these things become possible when you have sufficiently replicated and hacked reality with a virtual copy. Mm-hmm. So forget all the little, you know, chicken shit kid stuff we're doing now. This is just early days testing. We've like cracked open somebody's skull and we're poking their brain and seeing what parts of their body move.
Right.
Like that's literally what we're up to. The more that we map out that experience, the more that we start to understand how to play the piano. And then once we know how to play the piano, we can compose music.
Yep.
And then we have new kinds of music and new kinds of emotions that are touched and triggered as a result of that. So what Magnopus was started to do was we wanted to move experience beyond the rectangle.
Yes.
Coincidentally, around the same time, the hardware, we felt that it was going to be possible because, you know, we're visual effects people. Around that same time, the hardware became possible with Oculus and Magic Leap and... You know, a lot of the university institutions like Stanford and USC were coming up with things that was like, hey, we are now moving beyond this. We have the capability. So we started this company to explore that landscape in a very sort of scientific yet always motivated by creativity kind of way.
Yeah.
And see what are all these things? How do they work? How can we connect them into creating the next generation of types of experiences?
Right.
So what does Magnopus do? We are building virtual reality experiences and augmented reality experiences and platforms to enable those experiences. And in some cases, it's not even what you would consider virtual reality or augmented reality. We might be building a physical location where a group of people could participate in an experience that feels right. like the holodeck, for
example. Well, you were telling me that you've done a bunch of stuff for museum installations as well, right? So those are you're enabling technology to experience things in all kinds of different methodologies.
That's right. In industry, I mean, we're still doing some stuff with the movie business because we do virtual production and sometimes we do visual development for movies where it's like, okay, you have a specific complex problem you want to solve. Like, we'll tackle that because we have the sort of men and women here who have the brain power to tackle those kinds of problems. So fundamentally, the big picture is Magnopus exists to connect the virtual world with the real world.
Yes.
So exclusively virtual reality content, we're not that interested in.
No.
But where it connects with the real world, we're very interested in.
Okay.
And I would say that another key word about what we'll be announcing and the products that we're working on and the things that we're doing, a key word to keep in mind will be context. Because
context.
What we want to do is provide the world and humanity in general with superpowers that are driven by context.
Okay.
So the ability to have...
Not arbitrary, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So a better sense of understanding. That's part of the reason why we've done so much early exploration in the museum world. Mm-hmm. Because if you just... And most people don't really realize this. Museums have less than about 1.5% of their content on display. Most of it's in the basement.
Of course.
So look at the world. What is the number one biggest content powerhouse, like as an industry? It's Hollywood. Movies,
absolutely.
Generally speaking, and of that, Hollywood.
Yep.
When you want to talk about content, it's that. Number one content company in the world, probably Disney.
Okay.
Everybody else is like a distributor, but like you look at something like Disney, they look at all the intellectual property that they own for content creation, storytelling.
They own Marvel. Yeah. They own
Lucasfilm, like Pixar. It's like it's all. So look at look at content and look at storytelling. What is the thing that you're forgetting? Museums contain all of the artifacts and stories of our entire history of humanity.
Yes.
They would blow the Walt Disney Corporation out of the water just in the sheer amount of stories that exist in little brown boxes in the basement of a museum.
Yeah.
So we looked...
It's Indiana Jones, man.
Exactly. Which I guess it comes back to Lucasfilm, doesn't it? So ultimately, Disney owns that too.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point was is that we're exploring those things to provide the stories of humanity with context and special sort of powers and capabilities connecting the real world and the digital world. I've never actually said it that way before, but since you asked and knowing what you know and what you've seen, like that sort of in an abstract way.
It totally makes sense. I think finding that, and you know, the other thing that you're doing is you're looking at all this technology and you're finding out like, what works and what doesn't work, and you're not hedging your bets on anything. I think you guys are being very, very smart.
Well, we want to be honest and we want to share with everybody else. Like, hey, this didn't work for us. That doesn't mean it won't work for you, but here's why it didn't work for us. So save yourself the time and don't repeat our mistakes.
Sure.
Please create something amazing and share it with the world, because we'll be working on, you know, related concepts.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's awesome. The theory.
I love it. Well, this is it's been perfect. Is there anything else you want to share with us? Are you going to be able to make any announcements soon? Or should follow your website?
No. I am not going to build up any hype.
Okay, no, good. Of course not.
But we're making things. We've white labeled a lot of things. There's stuff out there in the real world that people are already using that we built. We just haven't told them about. We do have some pretty amazing stuff that we're working on. But the thing is that's cool about it is that it's hard, which is exciting. And hard stuff takes a little bit of time.
Of course.
So I would say that the thing that we would be really excited to tell you about, you probably won't find out about for at least 6 months to a year.
Okay.
But it'll be awesome when it happens.
That's awesome. Well, cool. All right. Yeah. Well, I'm going to let the last bucket drop, and then you and I are going to take a Polaroid picture.
Woo-hoo!
You have to find a good place for it.
Can do.
Thanks.